Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 7th of May, these are our main stories. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, says he's deeply concerned about the safety of Europe's biggest nuclear power plant in Ukraine as Russia begins evacuating people living nearby. King Charles and Queen Camilla are crowned on a day of pomp and coronation celebrations. The Saudi authorities say envoys from Sudan's rival military factions are in Jeddah for talks, though it's not clear whether they've actually met. Also in this podcast,
they have to give back our land, our former homes. Our lands, our homes are not there anymore.
We get reaction to a controversial repatriation plan for Rohingya refugees to Myanmar. We start with renewed fears of a nuclear disaster at the Zaporizhzhia power plant in Ukraine. Since Russian troops took control there in the early days of the war, there's been huge concern that fighting near it could cause a major accident. Now, the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog, Rafael Grossi, says he's extremely worried that the Russian forces there have been evacuating residents from the area. The Russian-installed head of the Zaporizhzhia region wrote on social media that in the past few days, Ukrainian shelling of settlements close to the front line, including the town of Enerhodar, had been stepped up. Our correspondent Bethany Bell, who's in Vienna, where the IAEA is based, told Chris Barrow what we know.
What the IAEA is saying is that it's got a group of experts which are based at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, and many of the staff in that power plant live in the town of Enerhodar, and they say they've received information that the evacuation of residents from that town has begun. Now, there's been a widely expected Ukrainian spring counteroffensive against Russian forces. That means it's very potentially dangerous for the nuclear power plant.
Because this area has been mentioned in the conflict several times, and there's been a few close calls around here. And just the importance of this site, I think it supplies 20% of Ukraine's power. So hugely important in all senses.
It's a major nuclear facility. There's been enormous worries in the past when there's been shelling, when there's been power cuts to the power plant itself as well, because it needs to have power in order to ensure its correct working and to have the cooling of fuel. And this is the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, has for a long time been calling on both sides, both the Russians and the Ukrainians, to establish a protection area around the site. They haven't been able to agree to anything yet, but Mr. Grossi has said he wants to have proper protection for the nuclear power plant.
It sounds like also that you're saying that this evacuation is because of Ukraine going on the offensive rather than Russia retaliating for that reported drone attack on the Kremlin. Is that your feeling?
Well, there were reports on Friday that the Russian-installed governor of the Zaporizhzhia region said he had ordered the evacuations of villages close to the front line with Ukrainian forces because he said Ukrainian shelling had intensified in recent days. And Enerhodar, of course, was one of the villages he had ordered to be evacuated. So now the IAEA says it's getting information that that evacuation from that town has begun.
That was Bethany Bell. Saturday was a day of pomp and pageantry in London as King Charles III and his wife Queen Camilla were crowned in an ancient and lavish ceremony at Westminster Abbey. This was Britain's first coronation and its biggest ceremonial event for 70 years. Charles became king of the UK and 14 other countries in September when his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, died. The BBC's Rob Watson watched the coronation and the parade that followed when thousands of military personnel marched through central London.
King Charles and Queen Camilla left Buckingham Palace in the ornate Diamond Jubilee coach drawn by six grey horses to be greeted by cheers from the vast crowds. their enthusiasm seemingly not dampened by the rain. The short route from the palace to the abbey was lined by 1,000 troops, while 200 mounted cavalry and full-dress uniforms accompanied the coach, a dramatic spectacle not seen or heard since the funeral of Winston Churchill in 1965. At the abbey where kings and queens have been crowned since William the Conqueror in 1066, bells rang out to mark the arrival of Charles and Camilla. Inside the abbey, a congregation of 2,000, including other senior members of the royal family, heads of state and government from around the world, British politicians, celebrities, and some 850 members of the public, watched the procession of the King and Queen and of the crowns and other regalia central to the ceremony. In a reminder, the coronation is, and has been for centuries, above all, a profoundly religious ceremony. The service was conducted and opened by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered to offer worship and praise to Almighty God, to celebrate the life of our nations, to pray for Charles, our King, to recognise...
Then the only part of the ceremony laid down in law... The coronation oath.
The coronation oath has stood for centuries and is enshrined in law. Are you willing to take the oath?
I am willing.
In one of several infusions of modernity and inclusion, and in a nod to Britain's much-changed ethnic and religious makeup, while the King vowed to defend and uphold Protestantism and the Church of England he heads, he also promised to be a defender of all faiths.
Grant that I may be a blessing to all thy children, of every faith and belief, that together we may discover the ways of gentleness and be led into the paths of peace. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Handel's famous and resounding Zadok the Priest, first performed for the coronation of George II in 1727, provided the overture for the most sacred, near mystical, and only hidden part of the ceremony dating back to the Old Testament of the Bible, the anointing of the king with holy oil, all shielded from public view by specially designed and embroidered screens.
Grant that this holy oil may be for thy servant Charles a sign of joy and gladness. That as king.
And then the moment of crowning, the Archbishop lowering the solid gold, jewel-encrusted 360-year-old crown of St. Edward onto the head of a solemn, calm and thoughtful-looking king.
King of kings and Lord of lords, bless, we beseech thee, this crown, and so sanctify thy servant Charles, upon whose head this day thou dost place it for a sign of royal majesty, that he may... God save the King!
God save the King!
Inside the abbey, chants of God save the King and the sound of its bells loudly ringing out. Outside, gun salutes across the country. The meticulously planned, carefully choreographed, and in the end, faultless service concluded with the national anthem as the man, born to be king, slowly processed his way through the abbey towards the 18th century Golden State coach and the journey back to Buckingham Palace as the country's oldest crowned sovereign. And in the now traditional and familiar end to all modern royal ceremonies, the king appeared on the balcony of Buckingham Palace to wave at the crowds gathered before him and to watch the flypast above.
That report was by Rob Watson. What then, I asked Rob, does the coronation tell us?
I think it's told us that Britain has moved on from the time of the coronation of the King's mother 70 years ago in the following sense, that
Yes, the ceremony was recognisable, would have been recognisable to a medieval king, Nick, in much of it. But moved on in the sense that Britain, 70 years on, is a far more multi-ethnic, multicultural, multinational, multi-religious society. And that was represented in terms of who was in the congregation, who made up the 2,100 who were lucky enough to be there for them, and in who took part in the service. And, of course, the very fact worth remembering that a Hindu prime minister in Rishi Sunak read a reading from the Bible.
And Rob, do you think we're seeing a change in the relevance of this institution, the monarchy?
You know, it's a very good question, and I think I'm going to quote a historian, a constitutional historian, a man called Vernon Bogdanor, who says monarchy is no longer a mystical, magical institution. It's a public service institution, and it will be evaluated now in those terms. I mean, I think that's right in the sense that the monarchy is aware that it needs to think of a new way to be relevant in a less, and how one put this, in a less reverential era. But they know that they also need to retain some of the majesty, some of the pageants that we saw. So it's a work in progress, but I think it is a monarchy in transition. But it's, in some ways, it's a very difficult square to circle. I mean, how do you achieve that? How do you become less stuffy, less old-fashioned looking, but while still maintaining that ability to provide the sort of awe that we saw?
And even if they do manage to do that, square that circle, there will always be protest. We saw vocal, relatively small protests. How significant are they?
I don't think those protests are hugely significant. There were hundreds of people. I think the challenge is more along these lines. For a lot of people, Nick, particularly those, say, above 30, above 40, for them, the monarchy really does represent stability, continuity and pride. It's hugely important. That is so much less so with people who are under 35. So the challenge for the monarchy is really how do you deal with that? How do you make sure, from their point of view, that young people start to feel the same kind of things that older people do? And perhaps one way of doing that is to see more of Prince William and other members of the royal family.
That was Rob Watson. The Iraqi Prime Minister, Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, has called for urgent intervention by the international community to help his country counter severe water shortages. He blamed climate change for unprecedented droughts there. Mike Thompson has more.
Prime Minister al-Sudani said curbing the growing water shortages facing Iraq was now his government's top priority. In addition to the serious problems caused by insufficient drinking water, he said the lack of supplies for agriculture had caused a steep decline in crop production. The Prime Minister appealed to Turkey, the source of both the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, to allow more water to flow downstream to Iraq. He also announced that his government was planning to resort to the desalination of seawater to help ease shortages, a costly method that will take time to develop.
Mike Thompson. The Saudi authorities say envoys from Sudan's warring military factions are in Jeddah for talks, but it's not clear whether they've actually met. Both sides have said they're ready to discuss a truce to address the humanitarian situation there, but they've not committed to ending the fighting. Meanwhile, in Sudan itself, airstrikes and street battles have continued in the capital Khartoum. The fighting has entered its fourth week now. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told Rob Young what we know about the talks and first, what's been happening on the streets of the capital.
Well, there has been some fighting, not many details of how widespread it is, but certainly two areas of Khartoum and Bari having some serious fighting going on between the two sides. But perhaps the most interesting sort of incident of insecurity happened when the Turkish ambassador's car was shot at. Turkey have put out a statement saying that basically both the army and the rival rapid support forces had been alerted that the ambassador was going to travel from the residence, we presume, to the embassy. But as soon as the car got out on the street, it was shot at. We don't know who by, and this is kind of a sign of you know, just how dangerous the city is, but perhaps also a sign of the lack of kind of command and control of the forces if it wasn't a deliberate act. And Turkey, of course, unlike most countries around the world, had stayed there. Its embassy was still there in Khartoum. Other countries were flying all their diplomats out. But even Turkey has now said, right, well, we're going to move the embassy to Port Sudan. So a sign that things are still very volatile in the capital.
And despite this volatility, despite the ongoing fighting, there is an attempt by Saudi Arabia to try to bring about either a proper ceasefire that is observed or perhaps some longer-term solution. Do we know who is likely to be meeting in Saudi Arabia and what they're likely to be talking about?
All we're told is that these are representatives of the two sides. We haven't been given any names yet, and both the RSF, Rapid Support Forces, and the army have expressed a kind of willingness to take part in these talks, which would be the first face-to-face talks, albeit with representatives rather than the key characters, as it were, in the war. But from the kind of tone of the messages that both sides have put out, they're really talking about a humanitarian ceasefire, some kind of a truce that would allow people, for example, who are trapped in their homes in Khartoum to get out and get supplies and for humanitarian aid to come in. But they're not talking at the moment in their messaging at all about finding a long-term solution to this. The head of the RSF, General Hemeti, as he's known, he did speak about a willingness for there to be a transition to civilian rule, which of course seems a long way off at the moment, given that they were in the middle of a war. And the army was also talking about renewing the truce, or at least the terming of their discussion was about the truce and not so much about ending the war. And frankly, given that both sides have been destroying parts of the capital and ignoring certainly some aspects of the ceasefires, even if the fighting has lessened in some areas, there's still been serious fighting between the two sides. It doesn't give us a lot of hope that the two generals at the moment are ready to stop the fighting. The hope, I guess, is that they'll inch towards that by agreeing on some kind of a truce that this time might hold. And that would come as a huge relief, especially to the, more than 7 million people who live in Khartoum.
Will Ross. Still to come. Republican protesters opposed to a monarchy in Britain. A number of them were arrested on Coronation Day.
The Global Jigsaw is the new podcast from BBC Monitoring, the BBC team tracking and analysing media in 100 languages. We're lifting the language barrier, showing you the world through the eyes of its media, where conflicting narratives are competing to influence your views. Search for The Global Jigsaw wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back. He was an avid supporter of Russia's decision to invade Ukraine, and in many ways. Zakhar Prilepin was a political campaigner, a soldier, novelist and essay writer as well. And on Saturday, he was blown up in his car, suffering serious injuries. His driver was killed. Prilepin is the third Russian propagandist to be attacked like this. Our Europe regional editor Paul Moss told me about the man.
He's like a character out of a Russian novel. Perhaps not surprisingly, he was a novelist himself. Yes, Mr. Prilepin comes from a village in rural Russia, southeast of Moscow. When he was 21, he went off to fight in Chechnya, where there was an independence movement that later brutally crushed by forces loyal to Moscow. Then he became a journalist, a rather successful one, but he complained that newspapers were cowardly, so he decided that novels were the best way to express his views. Then he got involved in politics as a campaigner for several nationalist-orientated parties. One was so extreme it was actually banned in Russia. Not surprisingly, he was very in favour of Russia first occupying Crimea and eastern Ukraine, and then he supported the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. He went there to fight as a volunteer, and he showed off that his unit, he said, had killed many Ukrainians.
And Paul, tell us a bit more about what happened.
He was being driven in the region where he lived, Nizhny Novgorod, and his car blew up. It's not clear at the moment if there was a car bomb attached or one of those improvised explosive devices that went off by the roadside. Either way, when you look at the photographs from the scene, you see this huge crater and this car upside down next to it. It's hard to imagine that anybody survived. The driver was killed, but we're told that Mr. Prilepin is alive, although he has very serious injuries.
And do we know who was responsible for it?
pick your choice, Nick. I mean, it's like some Agatha Christie novel with lots of people having a motive, the finger being pointed in all directions. First out of the block was the Russian Foreign Ministry. I mean, before the dust had even settled, they were saying that the United States was responsible. Unusually, they also blamed Britain, though there was no evidence given. The Kremlin blamed what they called Nazi terrorists. I should say the word Nazi is now used by the Kremlin for just about anyone they don't like. The Russian authorities said they'd arrested someone. Ukraine suggested in a sort of cryptic statement maybe this was about Russian infighting. Not so unlikely when you look at the splits that have opened up over the war in Ukraine and how it's been conducted. And then a group called Atesh claimed responsibility. This is a partisan movement from occupied Crimea. They issued a statement, said they'd been hunting for Zakhar Prilepin since the beginning of the year, said he wasn't driving alone. He had a surprise under his car. And for good measure, it wasn't enough to blow him up. They threw in what I presume they thought would also really hurt any self-respecting Russian writer. In their statement, they also said he was a rubbish novelist.
That was Paul Moss. Refugees the world over are often conflicted, torn between the desire to go home and the need to feel safe. And that is the dilemma facing the more than a million Rohingya refugees who are living in crowded camps in southeastern Bangladesh. They fled there 6 years ago from Myanmar after a military campaign in Rakhine State in which many people were killed or raped and their villages were razed to the ground. Bangladesh wants to repatriate them, but a group who've just visited Myanmar said they were unhappy with the repatriation plans and they didn't want to go back. Our Asia Pacific regional editor, Michael Bristow, told us more.
Well, this is the first group of Rohingya refugees who've gone back from Bangladesh to Myanmar to have a look at the repatriation facilities and preparations which are being made in order to bring about a million Rohingyas back from Bangladesh. Now, what they've come back and said, this delegation, is unequivocally that they don't like what they see. And that broadly falls into two areas. One, there's the safety. They don't feel safe. Also, they're not being offered citizenship back in Myanmar, which has always been a big bugbear with the Rohingyas because they're treated as second-class citizens in Myanmar. And there's also the practicalities of it. They believe what they've seen is that they're going to be going back into camps, guarded, not being allowed to go back to their villages and get on with their own lives as they see fit. So because of those reasons, they don't like what they see. This is what one of the delegation members had to say when he got back.
They have to give us our national identification card. They have to give back our land, our homeland, our former homes. Our lands, our homes are not there anymore. Only camps are there.
So that was Abu Sufyan, one of the people who went back from the Rohingya community. So what happens now, Mickey?
It's difficult to say because we have a million Rohingya refugees in squalid camps, cramped up in Bangladesh. Bangladesh is really keen for them to go back. Several members of the government from Bangladesh went with this delegation to Myanmar. They've come back and saying, well, look, it's still going to go ahead. But it's hard to see how it's going to go ahead if the Rohingya are refusing to go. And the UN have already said that no refugee should be forced back unless they're willing to go back on their own volition. So we're a little bit of a crossroads and it's hard to see it moving anywhere. And we have been here before. For the last several years, Bangladesh and occasionally Myanmar have been pushing this repatriation programme. So far, nothing's happened.
Perhaps the difference this time is that there is pressure, if you like, from Beijing. They've been trying to broker this. So might that push things forward?
Beijing, China certainly has been involved in the diplomatic effort to get refugees back for a number of reasons. One, for prestige. Beijing over recent years has really upped its profile in trying to negotiate and mediate in international disputes. For many other reasons as well, China's got a lot of business interests in this region. Myanmar is on its doorstep. It doesn't want an unstable Myanmar. So for these reasons, it wants to try and negotiate a deal, but it hasn't worked so far. And I think one of the reasons is that it's not seen as an honest broker by the Rohingya. It's really involved Bangladesh and Myanmar in the negotiations, not really the Rohingya. The Rohingya also see how the Chinese have treated the Uyghurs, the Muslim Uyghurs in Xinjiang, China's region of Xinjiang. So for those reasons, I don't think China's leverage with the Rohingyas is quite what it could be to get them to move on this.
Michael Bristow. Let's return to our main story now, the coronation of King Charles and Queen Camilla. Thousands lined the streets of London to try to catch a glimpse of them. But not everyone was happy. There were anti-monarchy demonstrations in some British cities. In London, several hundred protesters in Trafalgar Square booed repeatedly during the coronation service as it was relayed to crowds.
God save the King!
Well, protesters also chanted slogans including, "Not my King." Well, video footage showed several protesters dressed in T-shirts emblazoned with the words "Not my King" being detained by police officers. Elsewhere in some countries where the King is still head of state, the coronation has prompted fresh debate about whether they should become republics. Foremost in that debate is Professor Rosalia Hamilton, who lives in the Jamaican capital, Kingston. She's an advocate of getting rid of the King of Jamaica. The Caribbean island has already established a constitutional reform committee to examine turning Jamaica into a republic. First, you'll hear from Paul Powsland, a British barrister who held up a blank sheet of paper outside Parliament last year ahead of the late Queen's funeral and was approached by a police officer asking for his details. He claims he was also threatened with arrest. He attended the anti-monarchy protest in London. Rob Young asked him why.
I wanted to be there partially for reasons of freedom of speech. I believe it's really important that we should be allowed to give our opinion. But actually, I was going to speak at a rally that Republic were due to hold at the coronation today. And when I was going to speak, I was going to talk about the things that I love about these lands and about the people that I share them with, and why by having a king and a monarchy, I think sometimes we lose sight of the things actually we should be proud of our country for. But I never got to make that speech because the police arrested all of the leaders of the Republic NGO and stopped that rally going ahead.
Rosalie, were there protests in Jamaica, or were many people maybe watching the coronation ceremony?
Most people were going about their business as usual. Today is just another Saturday morning in Jamaica. The sun is hot. People are just getting on with life. I've spoken to people in the supermarket and so on, and they don't know what's happening. And the questions I've been getting is, which king? Who is this king? I haven't been watching. We are actively organizing a discussion forum today where we are contemplating what it will take to create a republic.
Why is it important to you to become a republic? And I just wonder what the new head of state would be. What powers would they have?
And that's exactly the conversation we're having. It is important to move away from the king as a head of state. I mean, he symbolizes the suffering of our people. He has benefited personally from the wealth created on the backs of our ancestors. His family was actively involved in the trafficking and enslavement of Africans. That's who he represents. And until a formal apology and a process of reparatory justice starts, that's the image we have. What we replace it with is an internal conversation. And that's exactly what we're going to be talking about. The government has set up a constitutional reform committee. It has been set up without any schedule and process of citizen engagement. And so we have started a citizen participation campaign where we're saying to Jamaicans, you must have a say in the arrangements going forward.
King Charles has talked about what he called the appalling atrocity of slavery. Did that go some way to addressing the concerns that you have?
Well, we listened with curiosity for the statement because we definitely are interested in giving him all the information he wants about the enduring legacy of slavery. We are interested also to hear that he wants to get more research done on his family's active engagement. Of course, the historians have told us that long ago, but it's good to know that he wants to see the research, wants to see the evidence, but we're much more interested in what he does with that information.
Paul, opinion polls in the UK consistently show that most Brits prefer the constitutional monarchy to for example, a directly elected president. And the argument is generally put that the royal family is cheaper than a full presidency would be. There is something to be said for the continuity and stability that they provide, as well as the economic boost, because people often come to the UK to visit Buckingham Palace, for example. How do you respond to those kind of critiques of your argument?
As to the opinion poll issue, yes, I have to say that, you know, republicanism is a minority opinion in the UK still, but it's not a fringe opinion. 25%, I think the latest poll showed, of people not wanting the monarchy, and it's now a majority amongst young people. And I sort of thought today, and maybe this sounds like a crazy idea, but why weren't even Republican opinions put into the ceremony today? And at the very least, we should be given the right to hold our own rally at the same time, because we represent millions of people who think that the monarchy is outdated and a waste of money. And dealing quickly with those other arguments you raised, that an Irish-style presidency costs significantly less than the monarchy in the UK. And I think there's also an issue of principle here, that regardless of the economics of it, as citizens, we should be given a right to select our head of state. And if, for instance, we'd had an election and Charles had been duly elected by everyone as our head of state, which he might well be, given his lineage in the royal family, then I would respect that. But I find it hard to respect it when it's foisted upon us.
Paul Powersland, and we also heard from Professor Rosalia Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter, of course, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Alison Davis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
From global current affairs to art, science, and culture, the documentary from the BBC World Service tells the world's stories. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.